Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is good to be with you today. We've got a great conversation ahead of us. We're going to talk about Islam, the appeal of Islam to youth. Why? What would be so appealing about Islam to youth, especially to young men, particularly in the Middle East? We're going to talk about that here in just a little bit with our expert, Dr. Timothy Furnish. Hope you can join us for that conversation. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin, go to our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo there in the sponsor section. Click on that, and that'll give you more information about Concordia University Wisconsin, the good work they're doing. Thanks for your support, Concordia University Wisconsin. Joining me by phone today, Dr. Timothy Furnish. He has a PhD in Islamic history from The Ohio State University. He serves as our expert on Islam here. Thanks so much for being our guest today on Faith and Family, Dr. Furnish.
Glad to be here, Andy.
Tell us a little bit about, tell us about your background, your experience. You do a number of things today, working as a writer, a blogger, a consultant to the U.S. military. Tell us about your background and what drew you to that interest of studying Islamic history.
Well, a lot of it was serendipitous or divine. I'm not sure which one. I graduated from undergraduate and went to law school, and I hated it so bad I quit and joined the Army. And I wound up, this was back in the 80s when most of us, I went into Army Intelligence and wanted to get a language and signed up for a language. And I was hoping to get Russian, of course. This was the height of the Cold War. And for some strange reason, I was the only person in my intelligence class that got Arabic at the time. So I wound up learning Arabic. And then after doing my stint in the 101st, I just decided that since I wound up doing an MAR at right there at Concordia, by the way, and then I did a PhD at Ohio State, and Arabic was my primary language just because, again, I had already learned it. So I sort of, I guess, stumbled into or was guided in this direction, one might say.
Just kind of stumbled into it, happened to study Arabic, and then the rest is history, huh?
Islamic history.
Well, what when one goes on to study Islamic history, I mean, that I'm sure it's just interesting, fascinating. What did your family think when you told them you're studying Islamic history?
Oh, they didn't think that was too strange, I guess. I'd already expressed some interest in it earlier in some ways. They knew I wasn't converting or anything, so they weren't too concerned.
Where does the history of Islam begin? For those of us not familiar, I mean, you know, here in like Midwestern United States, some of us might be really knowledgeable, but I would say probably the majority of us only know, the only thing we know about Islam is probably what we see in the media, on the news, those types of things. Give us let's take a look at the history of Islam, where it begins, and help us understand Islam.
Well, a lot of people tend to accept, I found even Christians will do this, and oftentimes, interestingly enough, even conservative Orthodox Christians will sort of accept the Islamic narrative that Muslims come from Ishmael, not Isaac, which is interesting, which of course is sort of a pious fabrication come up by Islamic thinkers in order to write Muslims into the Judeo-Christian narrative, of course. So I think a more accurate way of looking at it would be that Islam is really, in many ways, it's akin to Judaism and Christianity in many ways. It's a monotheistic religion. It is not, sometimes you'll see these typologies where Judaism and Christianity are posited as Western religions and Islam as an Eastern religion, but that's not true at all, because the Eastern religions are the polytheistic ones like Hinduism and Buddhism. So in terms of world religious families, Islam certainly is on the monotheistic side with Christianity and Judaism. And I probably the best way to look at it is it's sort of a 7th century, in many ways, it draws upon heretical movements within Christianity. There is a lot in the Quran which is put together in the 7th century, or probably more likely in the later 8th century. There's a lot in the Quran that resembles things that show up in books that didn't make it into the New Testaments, for instance, the Gospel of Thomas and some of the apocryphal books. So I think it's clear that when Muhammad came along in the 7th century, and I do believe he existed, there are some folks that would argue that he didn't exist. I think he was a historical figure. But when Muhammad came along in the 7th century, his death date is usually given as 632 AD. that he basically had come into contact with Jews, particularly Christians in the Arabian Peninsula and environs, and then sort of cobbled together out of that a religion that in some ways resembles Judaism, Christianity, but in many other ways is quite different.
Now, if others listening to your description there, how would some quibble with your description of the history? Would a true Muslim quibble with how you just described the history of Islam there?
Oh, they wouldn't quibble with it, Andy. They'd reject it out of hand. But, you know, I'm looking at this as a historian, sure, and as a Christian, not as a, frankly, you get a lot of people in the media that basically repeat really almost sort of like mythologies, I guess is the best way to put it, about Islam. And even I taught world history and Middle East history at the college level for 7 years. And this sort of thing would show up even in, for instance, college textbooks. And I actually reviewed a couple of high school textbooks, and it shows up in them. By that, what I mean is this idea that, for instance, it is often presented in a history textbook that Muhammad received revelations from God. You rarely, if ever, will find college or high school history textbooks, at least in the public sector, that will say that, you know, Jesus was the Son of God, for instance. But yet they will take the believer's view from a Muslim point of view and enshrine that as historical fact. Now, I simply refuse to do that. I think if you look at the data, for instance, one thing, again, to come back to what I said a moment ago, for instance, it's very clear that a considerable number of things in the Quran are almost verbatim, translation being allowed into Arabic, verbatim takings or borrowings from some of the apocryphal, so-called apocryphal gospels. So I know there's this thing called the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. Just because B follows A doesn't mean A causes B. Just because there are things in the Quran that sound almost exactly like something in the Gospel of Thomas or some of these other gospels, that doesn't mean they came from there. But I think it's pretty clear indication that they probably did. So, and by saying that, I'm not saying that I think that, for instance, I was asked in an interview last week, do I think the Quran is evil? And I would answer that as a conservative Orthodox Christian and as a historian of Islam. I do not think the Quran is evil. There is a lot in the Quran that is violent, that is misogynistic, clearly. And I've done a lot of talks and lectures and over the last 6 months over this issue of beheading, because ISIS, mm-hmm, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham or Syria, is very fond of beheading. Some years ago, I wrote an article on this topic. So I've done a lot of interviews on this topic, for instance, and beheadings are clearly in two different passages of the Quran enjoined by Muslims upon what they call non-believers, that is, anyone that's not a Muslim. So it's really inaccurate, for instance, to say that ISIS or any of these groups that do this are going against Islam. No, what they're doing is enacting a very literalist 7th century view of Islam, but it is nonetheless Islamic. And I bring that up, again, to illustrate my point. The Quran is very violent when it's read literally. The hadiths, these are traditions or sayings that are attributed to Muhammad that are sort of extra Quranic, an extra Quranic corpus of literature that in many cases has taken a status of almost holy writ for Muslims. There are many violent, misogynistic, frankly just poisonous and toxic passages in these sources. And, however, there are also, for instance, a very good example, there's also some good stuff. There is no other world religion on the planet that explicitly mentions Jesus besides the New Testament except for the Quran. Now, does the Quran get Jesus right from our lights? Of course not. I mean, Jesus is posited as not the Son of God in Surah Al-Ma'idah. In fact, he even argues and says expressly, you know, it denies the Trinity, he denies the Trinity, and so on. But despite all of that sort of fog of misunderstanding and misrepresentation, Jesus is there, and there's a very high regard for Jesus among many, many, many Muslims, has been for 1,400 years. So I think that, so this is why, for instance, I wouldn't say that the Quran is evil, while I can at the same time say that I don't think it's accurate, and I don't think that it is divine revelation.
What are the What's the basic teachings of Islam? I understand that they recognize Jesus as maybe a prophet, and most of the teaching, as you said, comes from Muhammad. What is the life of a Muslim? What is life all about? What is life and death all about when it comes to Islam?
Well, it's very legalistic. One achieves salvation if one does, because it is never up to one. One can never be assured of salvation. In the final analysis, once you die and judgment comes, Allah will decide. Islamic theology teaches that if you follow the Sharia, the Islamic law, and there are different variations of that depending on which sect of Sunnism you are and whether you're Sunni versus Shia and that sort of thing. But in general, Islamic law is more or less pretty the same across a lot of the sects in many ways. If you follow Islamic law, if you follow the other strictures, you know, pray five times a day, the so-called five pillars of Islam, pray five times a day, fast during Ramadan, make the Hajj once in your life if you can, give alms or zakat to the poor, if you do these legalistic mechanisms, basically, you will hopefully please Allah enough that you will go to heaven and not to hell after the judgment. So in that sense, it's very unlike Christianity, because there is no Muhammad serves no salvific role other than, I mean, he's a prophet, and as you point out, Jesus is also a prophet. But there is no one in Islam, not Jesus, not Muhammad, who basically atones for the sins of the people. In fact, the very idea is considered absurd by Islamic thinkers and by Muslims themselves. So what you have to do is follow the rules. And if you follow the rules, you know, Allah willing, at the end of time, when judgment comes, you will not go to the place that is very, very unpleasant and very hot.
So it's all about following the rules, following the laws in order to go to heaven. And what is eternity, or what is heaven? Is it eternal? First of all, is heaven eternal? Is it forever, according to Islam?
Yes, it is. And it's very interesting. And people think that when you talk about this, people think that you're sort of making up a story to insult Islam, but really one is not. The descriptions of paradise in the Quran, as well as in the hadiths that I mentioned, are very sensual. It's very much of a place where it's the kind of place that you would certainly imagine that a desert people would picture as paradise. You know, it's not hot. There are cool lakes and streams, and there's milk and wine and such to drink, because of course Muslims are not supposed to drink wine during their lifetime. But also there are aspects to the Islamic afterlife that are quite problematic. Many of your listeners have probably heard that when these so-called Islamic martyrs kill themselves fighting for Allah, they will receive either 70 or 72, what are called virgins. And the actual word in Arabic in the Quran is huri, H-U-R-I. And a huri is basically a supernatural jinn-like creature. You may have heard of the jinn, the genies in Islam. They are sort of supernatural, corporeal creatures there's no other way to say this, that one can have sex with. And this is, and it's really not described as being a place so much for women as it is for men. Of course, Muslims, scholars have worked out a sort of idea of what heaven would be like for women, but the heaven that's described in the Quran and in the Hadith is almost exclusively one that would probably make, you know, that is designed to make men happy from that point of view. So it's quite unlike what you get, you know, the description of the heavenly kingdom or the New Jerusalem in the Book of Revelation, for example. You don't get anything about, you know, every tear being wiped away from every eye. You get a thing about, well, it's going to be an enjoyable, sensual place. So, and again, this is not a matter of interpretation. I mean, I've read the Quran in Arabic and in English, and that's literally what it says. So it's a little bit different, shall we say, than the view of heaven that we usually get in Christianity.
Is there, in looking at Islam compared to other religions, Is there a aside from the works to earn your way to this heaven that you just described? Is there any other way to this heaven? Is there any other hope other than is there any mercy or forgiveness in Islam?
Well, that's an interesting question because, again, remember, Islam is the world's second largest religion. Christianity, about 2.2 billion, and Islam, about 1.6 billion. Any organization that has over a billion people is not going to be uniform in thought, and Islam is not either. And this is, I sometimes take issue with some of my conservative friends on this issue, and sort of both sides of the political fence in America will tend to do this. Muslims are all X or Muslims are all Y, and that's simply not true. However, there are commonalities that we can talk about. Mm-hmm. But on this specific issue, yes, the standard, both Sunni and Shia, depending across sects of both Sunni and Shia Islam, the standard view is that one follows the rules and the pillars of Islam and so on and so forth, the Sharia, to get into heaven. However, there has been for about 1,200 years sort of a protest movement against that in Islam among a group of Islamic mystics called the Sufis. Now, the Sufis are not another sect of Islam. They're really kind of hard to describe or analogize to a Christian context. In some ways, they're sort of like charismatics. They believe in a direct experience of God. And the Sufis, if anybody's ever heard of the Sufis, it's a group like the so-called whirling dervishes, which is a Persian word for them. Darwish becomes dervish in English. If you go to Istanbul, for instance, today, these guys, they're an order of Sufis called the Mevlevis. The whirling dervishes, they spin around and go into a trance and try to pray and go into sort of a, like for instance, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, there's the Jesus Prayer, where one, and the famous, some of the famous mystics in the Western Church, in the Catholic Church, St. John of the Cross, Julian of Norwich, would go into mystical prayer where they believed they were having direct experience of God. The Sufis try to achieve the same thing with Allah from their point of view. And there are still hundreds, probably dozens at least, if not hundreds of Sufi orders in the world, among in the Islamic world, that number in the tens of millions, if not more. And these guys, not all of them, but a lot of them have, and these guys, I should say, and women, because there are women Sufi orders also, they, for many years, many of them have taken issue with this sort of one-size-fits-all Islamic view of salvation, and many of them believe that a direct experience of Allah is what allows one to achieve some sort of salvation. So, but again, it's not anything like the idea of atonement with Christ. It's I think a different path, sort of a less legalistic path from their point of view to Allah, which I think is somewhat different from the mainstream sort of Sunni idea, particularly.
Now, and much of your specialization has been on this the Islamic messianic movements as an expert in Islam. Who is this? Well, tell us about the messianic movements.
Well, in Islamic messianism is generally called Mahdism or Mahdiism. The word is Mahdi in Arabic, Mahdi. Means the rightly guided or the divinely guided one. And this is an idea that goes far back into Islamic thought. It started popping up not long after the Quran was put together. And the idea, and it's clearly to me, again, my book was on this topic, came out in 2005, called Holiest Wars. And I think it's pretty clear that, again, Islam being in the vein, many ways, of Judaism and Christianity, it takes messianism from Judaism and Christianity. But in order to differentiate itself from, Judaism, particularly Christianity, the religion in which the Messiah has come and will come again, I think Muslim thinkers in the early period came up with this idea that's slightly different. It's a twist. The Mahdi, which is a belief in both Sunni and Shia thought, is a fellow that will come before the end of time, along with the returned prophet Jesus, because in Islamic thought, Jesus, of course, comes back and reveals himself as a Muslim prophet, neither crucified nor resurrected, but he was taken to heaven, he comes back from heaven, and he and the Mahdi basically will work together to create a global Islamic state. They will fight the forces of evil. I mean, there's a whole sort of developed eschatological tableau, I guess, if you will, in Islam that's very similar to what we have in Christianity. There's Yajuj and Majuj, Gog and Magog. There's a creature called Al-Daba, the beast, like the beast of Revelation. There's an antichrist figure in Islamic thought and Islamic theology called the Dajjal, the deceiver. So Muslims believe that the Mahdi and Jesus will work together to defeat these basically forces of evil, take over the world for Islam, and then there, for some period of time, and it depends on which hadith you read and which tradition you go with, there will be a global Islamic state, sort of a kingdom of Allah on earth that will last for some number of years. And then Jesus and the Mahdi will both die because they're both just humans. And then at some point after that, things will start going bad, and then the world will go into all these sort of travails, more sort of like the Left Behind kind of things. and then the end of time will come, but that's sometime after that. So, but what's interesting about the Mahdi is again, a lot of people think that it's only a Shia belief, particularly a 12er Shia belief, Iran, Iraq, where maybe the 12ers predominate. But actually, again, it's a very strong belief in Sunni thought. The biggest difference is this. Both major sects of Islam believe in this Mahdi that will come, as I just described. For the Sunnis, he has not been here yet, although there have been any number of people over the course of the last 1,400 years that have claimed to be the Mahdi. None of these was the actual Mahdi. Like, for instance, just a few weeks ago, I watched again on TV, you may recall, maybe you're younger than me, though, Andy, a movie called Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan, which is a movie that came out in the early 60s with Charlton Heston and Olivier. And it's about this movement in the 1880s of this fellow in Sudan that claimed he was the Mahdi and got thousands, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of Sudanese to follow him in a holy war. In 1979, for instance, 1979 was the same year that the Iranian Revolution took place and the Islamic Republic was created. But also in that year, there was an attempt to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia. Some armed militants took over the Great Mosque in Mecca. And there are a lot of people that know about this, but what a lot of people do not know is that the leader of this group proclaimed his brother-in-law, one of the other in the group, to be the Mahdi. And in subsequent years, this has started popping up more often in smaller cases where someone in the Sunni world claims to be the Mahdi. Like, for instance, I've done on my website, in fact, I was working in the fourth one of these, I've done analyses of this magazine that the Islamic State or ISIS puts out called Dabiq. They've done three of these, and they've just done a fourth one, which I'm going to probably post on here soon. Dabiq, the very name Dabiq means is the name of an eschatological end-of-time battle that, according to Islamic traditions, will be fought in Syria between the pious Muslim armies and the quote-unquote Romans. And, of course, the Romans, Andy, would be us, Western Christians. So this idea is all over the place in Sunni thought. It's also in 12er Shia thought, that is, the Muslims of Iran and Iraq, as well as Lebanon and, to a lesser extent, Azerbaijan. Now, the big difference here is that for the 12er Shia, they believe that this Mahdi would be one of the descendants of Muhammad. Muhammad did not have any sons. That survived. He may have had a son that died in infancy. The records are kind of sketchy. He had mostly daughters. Muhammad, however, had a younger cousin named Ali, who became one of the caliphs after him. Ali married one of Muhammad's daughters, and therefore Ali's sons were Muhammad's grandsons. So the main group of the Shia, of which there are a number, called the 12er Shia, again, Iran and Iraq, came to believe that there were 12 descendants of Muhammad through Ali, each one of whom should have been the legitimate leader of the Islamic world, but who was not because of the perfidy and nefarious opposition of the Sunnis. And what happened was with the 12th Imam, who was named Muhammad, disappeared as a young kid in the 9th century AD. Now, as a historian, I think that he simply died. But if you had let him die, he's a 5-year-old kid, without any descendants, therefore that branch of the religion would have died out. So they came up with this elaborate, pious idea that he went into what's called occultation. He didn't die, he disappeared, and he's waiting to come back. And he is the one that will return at the end of time, what the Shia Muslims, these Shias, call the 12th Imam, who does the same role as the Mahdi in the Sunni Islamic world. So basically, and he will do the same thing that the Sunni Mahdi does, which is work with Jesus and take over the world. So that's what that belief means for Muslims. And Mahdism, whether Sunni or Shia, has been the source of some of the most violent, really apocalyptic jihads in Islamic history.
How very interesting. I want to talk more about, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about how this appeals then to young people. The Islam and all the various groups within Islam as well, how this appeals to young people and how proselytizing or recruiting of particularly young men happens. So we'll talk about that when we return right here on Faith and Family. We're talking with Dr. Timothy Furnish, doctorate in Islamic history from The Ohio State University. Hope you can join us for that conversation. All coming up right here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
October is National Down Syndrome Awareness Month, so I'm bringing you a special week's worth of Life Issues programs that share the beauty and blessings people with Down syndrome bring to families, friends, and society in general. Take Will Downs, who surprised his parents, Don and Glenn, at birth. At the time, they knew nothing about Down syndrome, but quickly learned. Looking back, and because of the tremendous blessing he's been to all around him, if they'd known about Will's condition beforehand, they would have never considered abortion. A teenager next door was so impacted by Will, he chose special education for a career. Sadly, up to 90% of mothers who get a Down diagnosis while pregnant opt for abortion. So you and I must be a loud voice for the babies.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on behalf of Concordia Plan Services, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, the LCMS Foundation, Lutheran Housing Support Corporation, Concordia University System, and Corporate Synod, daily reaches out to our members and partners, working together to support our local, global, and international ministries, church workers, and LCMS initiatives at large to carry the mission forward and to serve each other in love. Opportunities to serve, lcms.org/jobsboard.
Hi, this is Pastor Mark Azil, the LCMS Director of Campus Ministry and LCMSU, inviting all college students and those with an interest in campus ministry to join us for Taboo, the 2015 National LCMS Campus Ministry Conference, this coming January 5th through 7th at St. Louis University in St. Louis. That's right, it's Taboo in the Lou. Find out more at lcms.org/LCMSU.
Reverend Dr. Matthew C. Harrison of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod recently said these words regarding the importance of the work of Concordia Historical Institute.
When you forget your past, you forget the gospel. You become locked into your own little part of time. As you study the past and know the past and know what happened in the past, you see God at work. And you see Christ.
Discover your Lutheran history at ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org.
Listening to Worldwide KFUO on the go with your smartphone doesn't mean you have to walk around with earbuds all day. You can Bluetooth across the room to a speaker system in your home or listen on radios that have built-in smartphone cradles. There are many easy ways to listen to WorldwideKFUO.org on the air, online, and on demand. We proclaim the clear gospel message of Christ crucified for our sins. The messenger of good news, Worldwide KFUO.
Hey, Pastor Craig D'Onofrio here. We're getting close to Reformation Day, but did you know that Mondays through Fridays are always Reformation Days? That's right, Reformation Rush Hour is Monday through Friday. Join me at 5 p.m. Central and enjoy our fascinating guests on Worldwide KFUO. All treats, no tricks. KFUO.org or in the St. Louis area, AM 850 KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Today we are talking with Dr. Timothy Furnish, our expert in Islamic history. And you've got a presentation coming up pretty soon, don't you, Dr. Furnish?
Yes, I'll be at the seminary this Thursday, God willing, to speak on this topic at, I believe, 4:15 your time.
Very good. Yeah, 4:15 at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis in Werner Auditorium, fighting for the end of the Christian world, fighting for the end of the world, the Christian world, focusing on the eschatology of ISIS and other modern Muslim groups in light of Islamic history and doctrines. Very interesting. And I'm enjoying the conversation right now, so I know that this presentation is going to be certainly engaging and interesting as well. Up to this point, we've covered a brief history of Islam, and I've learned that there are several groups or sects, as you mentioned earlier, within Islam that have differing views on the end times and also some of their basic beliefs sound to be a little bit different. I'm curious what this means for proselytizing or converting, especially young people. What is life like in cultures, in parts of the world where Islam is the predominant religion? What is the culture like? How is it embedded into the culture, if you will?
Right. I mean, very much so. In some ways, more than Christianity is here, because again, we've had several centuries of the official disestablishment of Christianity. No nation that is a majority Muslim has ever really disestablished Islam as the religion, except for Turkey after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And of course, if you follow geopolitics much at all in the last decade or so, Turkey has kind of gone back the other way, become a bit more Islamic, although it has never officially repudiated its post-World War I sort of secular republic creation. But for the vast majority of Muslims living in Muslim-majority societies, there is really little. There's not true that it's not. There's not any, but there's very little distinction between church and state. And this has profoundly affected people. Another thing I should say too is that kids that go to school, for instance, in a Muslim-majority state, almost never learn anything about any other religions. If you're a Coptic Christian in Egypt, you have to take classes on Islam, and you can't not know about Islam, although the Copts, C-O-P-T-S, make up about 9-10% of the population of Egypt. And as we know, they were persecuted, particularly again in recent years under the Muslim Brotherhood rule before it was short-circuited. But for instance, if you grew up as a Copt in Egypt, you can't not know about Islam, but Muslims can grow up in Egypt and never learn anything about Christianity. So I think that's a lot of it. It's that they simply, and needless to say, of course, they never learn anything about Hinduism or Buddhism or anything like that. They just, unless they perhaps go to some, private school where that's taught, but that's almost never the case. So it's part of the culture. They don't learn, and I think a lot of it's by design. They don't learn about anything else. Because, again, the assumption in the Islamic world, going back to Muhammad himself, has been that the state will be Muslim and Islam will be the official religion. The idea that, of course, that we have, which was the reading yesterday, right, which was the gospel yesterday, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's, you don't have that distinction in Islam. And Islam did not spend 300 years as a persecuted minority under other kind of rule, as the Christian church did under Roman pagan rule. So these historical things have made a very deep imprint on Islamic culture. And then, of course, you have other issues that it's a very, it's a Middle Eastern, it's a very patriarchal culture. Perhaps the culture is not, depending on where you are, the culture is not perhaps it's not fair to call it misogynistic, but women certainly are considered, you know, to have, I think it's safe to say, fewer rights in most Muslim areas than they do in the West. So all of that goes together to contribute to the views that especially the young people have.
And that was my next question, was what women in cultures in where this where Islam is predominant, how does this religion appeal to them?
Yes, that's very interesting. I mean, I think it's perhaps easy to say, if I do this, and it's probably easier to start out with why it appeals to men and then see,
sure,
then kind of segue into why it appeals to women.
Okay, let's do that.
Why it appeals to men, I mean, this is one thing that we've been looking at, and in the, you know, with some folks I've been consulting with, also with some folks and some other media outlets that I've been working with. You know, as people probably know, you read the news reports and all, ISIS doesn't seem to have any trouble recruiting, does it? The Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, or the Islamic State of Syria, or as the president likes to call it, ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Whatever, it's the same group. They don't seem to have any problem recruiting, particularly
right,
young men, and not just from the Middle East. I mean, we've all seen the news stories, I would think. Folks, young men are coming from France, they're coming from Britain. There was an article a few weeks ago that said there were actually more Muslims from Britain serving as jihadists for ISIS than there were serving in the British Army, which is rather problematic. There's also been, depending on who you listen to, anywhere north of 100 ISIS recruits from the United States. Now, I think a couple of factors probably come into play here. I dare say that if one did a detailed background dossier on these guys, I would be willing to bet that most of them don't have any strong religious belief at all. So, you know, the famous dictum by St. Augustine, you've got that hole inside of you and you want to fill it with something. Well, they're filling it with this. And for people that don't have any strong religious beliefs themselves, Islam can certainly be very appealing. It's very simple. You know, God is one. There's no Trinity. You know, all you have to do is say, La ilaha illa Allah wa Muhammad Rasulullah three times. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger three times, and you're a Muslim. You know, you don't have to learn those long creeds that we have on Sunday. Certainly, you don't have to ever wade through the Athanasian Creed. So it's very simple in many ways. I think it also appeals to a certain mindset, and I don't think this is paranoid to say this. I think it's safe to say that, particularly in the public schools in the West, that Christianity has been getting the short end of the stick for decades. I mean, again, I taught college history. I reviewed certainly high school history textbooks sometimes for publishers. And it was clear that, you know, for instance, you often would get the worst view of Christianity presented. Christianity, the Crusades, you know, slavery, that sort of thing. And other cultures around the world, were particularly the Islamic culture, when you're talking about something like the Crusades, are almost always presented in public education venues. Again, not always, but quite often, as the victims. The West is always the oppressor, the colonial overlord, and, you know, again, I taught college history for 7 years, and it would always amaze me that the kids would come into my class, college, mind you, and had no idea that there was a slave trade that existed in the world other than the transatlantic one. Hmm. You would have thought that the British in 1859 invented slavery, you know. They didn't know that a quarter of the population of the Roman Empire was slaves, or that there was an extensive Islamic slave trade taking, you know, white Europeans and taking them as slaves from Italy and southern France and places like that that went on for centuries. So part of it, I think, is that Islam can be appealing if you have been raised in an environment where the schools have taught you that Western civilization has been a domineering overlord exploiting the rest of the world for centuries, then therefore when you see a religion that is not of that culture and that it purports to be sort of redressing grievances against the West, then that can seem appealing, even to someone that I think is not initially Muslim. And then part of it, too, I think, is simply that, look, these are 19-year-old guys, and I vaguely remember being 19, but my children are in middle school. I'm starting to see this already. I have two boys. But, you know, 19-year-olds have, I think perhaps I'm not going too far uncharitably to say, have perhaps more testosterone than brain cells. And so young men that would perhaps in another context join the Marine Corps, right, mm-hmm. wind up thinking, oh, look, adventure. I can go off to Syria, and especially if they've converted to Islam. And some of the worst of these are the converts. The zeal of the convert is not just something that is, you know, applied to Christians. The zeal of the Muslim convert can also often be quite bloody. And these guys say, look, here's a group that's standing up for a persecuted group and because they're convinced that Muslims are persecuted. And you know, I can go fight. I can literally go fight. It's, you know, instead of Che Guevara, it's now bin Laden or al-Baghdadi or, you know, pick a jihadist leader. So I think all of that goes together and appeals to young men. And even, interestingly enough, and sort of sadly, but the beheadings and such horrible atrocities that they commit, they appeal to a certain small demographic slice, particularly of males, who find that sort of unbridled power something they wouldn't mind being part of. Now, I think that to some measure, I'm just a historian. You'll have to get a psychologist to really unpack that one for you, Andy. But I think that does sort of begin to approach some avenues of how you see how young men are attracted to groups like this or and to Islam in general. And again, all Muslims are not ISIS. I realize that. But there's sort of a continuum there. Mm-hmm. Now, why do women do it? Now, this is a very interesting question. A few years ago, I quit teaching college in 2007. In the last year I taught college, I had two young ladies that showed up in my class. They had taken one of my previous world history classes, and they showed up in a Middle East history class that I had started teaching. Both of them had converted to Islam in the interim. And one of them actually wore all black. Her face was uncovered. Everything else was covered with black. The other woman covered everything but her face, but she was, you know, much more liberal. Her outfit was multicolored, although it covered everything. So, I just wanted to take them aside and say why, but of course I can't do that in a public university system. Personally, I don't know, but it's very interesting. I've done some study recently of I don't know if you've seen some of these articles. I think the New Yorker had a big article a couple of weeks ago, and there was a couple of other in the media about the so-called women of ISIS. And the methodology is much the same. You know, the ISIS throws this stuff out on the internet. They put English language stuff out as well as Arabic stuff. They tweet. They can get a Facebook page to stay up. They do that. And they try to draw these women in. They also draw the men, of course, through mosques, various mosques where the imams are, shall we say, sympathetic to them. And it's not that hard to get talked to, if you are willing to do it, to wind up with a plane ticket to Ankara or Istanbul, and then you wind up on the Syrian border. Boom, you're in, you know, one of these cities. You're in Raqqa or something in Syria. You're wearing all black. You are not allowed to fight, however, but you are allowed to hopefully have as many children as you can for the jihad. I think some of the same factors that are active in why young men would be attracted to Islam in general, and perhaps, let's just leave it at that, Islam in particular apply here. You know, it's simple. You know, look, it would be the ultimate act of rebellion, wouldn't it? If you're raised in, admittedly, as I said, though, a lot of these people coming to this religion because they don't have any deep beliefs. But if you were raised in a Christian family and you really wanted to hack your parents off, I don't know what you could probably do that would do it more than converting to Islam, you know, at least in my household. But I think that's part of what's going on. Some of it's just rebellion. Some of it is these women are simply led astray. They're promised things that, you know, aren't going to materialize or are simply untrue. And I think a lot of it is simple ignorance. I mean, I look at these women and I think, how many of you have actually read Surat An-Nisa, where it says that a man is allowed four wives, plural? Well, it says plural wives, and the four is basically from a hadith that's what Muhammad said. So you're allowed four wives. And it says specifically in the Quran that if they misbehave, you are allowed to beat them. So I wonder how many women have actually read that. And one thing I found with a lot of converts to Islam is that they're really woefully ignorant of Islam. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they take umbrage at the fact that I'm a non-Muslim, and I will, you know, sort of gently suggest that perhaps they don't know as much as they do. But that often is the case. And, I mean, you've seen this. There was just an article last week, again, about this women of ISIS and this one gal who had gone off gung-ho and converted, and then she found out she was basically under virtual house arrest, and her job was to have young jihadists, as many as possible, and there were going to be other wives besides her, which sort of, I think, would sort of make you not feel very special, one would think. So I think a lot of it is just ignorance. I think it's just sort of misguided zeal to again, fill that hole inside of them with something. And this sounds, even for a woman, it's adventure. I'm going to go to Syria and I'm going to do this. And I mean, ISIS, for instance, again, in these magazines that I've studied, they say, well, come on over. We have empty houses. But yes, from all the Yazidis and Christians that you've run out, they've empty houses that you can have. The Islamic State needs you. And I think people just, a lot of it is just, frankly, ignorance. They fall for this.
Here in, it's understandable in, I mean, I understand how in cultures where Islam is the predominant religion, how it can be appealing to young men and even young women, as you've described. And here in Midwestern culture in the United States, you've described, you know, how it might be a form of rebellion for some. As a former college professor, encountering students, I know a while back you wrote, back in 2009, wrote an article for the Lutheran Witness, and you mentioned, you quoted a common quote you hear from students: "I believe in Jesus as a prophet, not as the Son of God." How is this not uncommon on college campuses? How is it that we hear this frequently in academia today?
Right. It's the, you know, sort of the leveling effect that all religion, and again, I think this is largely a result of public education, which is, for the most part, dominated by a liberal mindset. And the liberal mindset is, if not openly hostile, then certainly at best indifferent to Christianity. In fact, I tend toward more the openly hostile. I mean, you go back to the Enlightenment, and people will ask me this, and this is a related issue. Why does the left defend Muslims? Like, I was on the Alan Colmes show a few weeks ago talking about beheading, and Alan Colmes, you know, the famous liberal on Fox, Alan Colmes spent, in fact, almost the whole time arguing with me about, well, Muslim, and I'd say, well, the Quran says behead. Well, but the Crusades. Well, but the Bible. It got rather comical almost. But the sort of, you know, as we used to say in the academy, the sort of meta-narrative there is, why is a man who is not a Muslim and a liberal defending Islam in this issue? And I think it goes back, I blame two people, Voltaire and Marx. I mean, the left takes their cues, if you go back far enough, and not that this was all bad, but Voltaire's idea of, you know, not forcing someone to be a religion because the state is that religion, and, you know, that sort of idea in the Enlightenment ultimately was part of our founding in this country, where we divorced, we did not have an official religion at the federal level. But then that gets compounded for many on the left as you come up through the 19th century and the early 20th century with Marx, who was, I think it's safe to say, much more even openly hostile to Christianity. And on the left, and, you know, by that I mean capital L left, not necessarily the, you know, the Democrat that works on the assembly line, but I mean the hard L left ideologue types, many of whom write curricula and teach in our schools, they think that Christianity, to go harken back to what I said a bit earlier, Christianity is the only Christian civilization and the Christian church, the only entities that are ever oppressive and colonial and all that sort of thing. And I think that gets pounded into people at the public school level. And I think that then, basically what you get is almost, maybe not a tacit alliance, but a non-belligerence pact between the left and Islam. So that, you know, I don't think there's a very clear, I think it's easy to slide from being, well, the Western civilization, which is predominantly Christian, is a problem, and it's been predatory on the rest of the planet. Therefore, I'm going to join a religion that is the opposite. I think that to me that elision between those two is what happens, and I think a lot of it, unfortunately, is from the public schools.
There's, in having worked in higher ed myself, there's, I don't know, it seems like because it's a minority in, because Islam is a minority in this country, then it, saying things like that, I believe in Jesus just as a prophet, not as the Son of God. Well, certainly you can say that in any public setting, because for many, that's not a religious statement. You're not declaring any, you're not showing, you know, one particular religion over another. You're not, you know, saying that one is greater over another.
Jesus but, is not exclusive in that formulation.
Right. But in a sense, you are. When you say that too, you're saying that these other you're giving preference to other religions that say that Jesus is not God, that he's not the Son of God.
Well, I think basically, again, if you've been in higher education, you know this. Basically, one of the tenets, one of the primary tenets of higher education, again, which is dominated by the left, is that basically our religions more or less teach the same thing. You know, this, we see this all the time in the media, in the President of the United States making speeches. You know, Islam is a religion of peace. I'm like, really? Have you actually read that book? And of course, people will come back and say, well, but the, like Combs did with me, but the Old Testament, this, that, and the other. And I said, well, and I would say, of course, but there's not a global movement of long-bearded Orthodox rabbis seeking to impose the Torah on you at the point of a sword. There is, however, a global movement of Muslim guys, many of which have long beards, seeking to impose Islam on you at the point of a sword. So, you know, don't deny reality. I think that, again, to go back to your original question, I think the public schools, both primary, secondary, and colleges, basically sort of teach this leveling thing where all religions teach the same, which if you take 5 minutes and study the world religions, it's frankly absurd. You know, it's just frankly absurd. But I think that is just inculcated in people. And it's, and even people, I've run into people at church that say the same thing to me, you know, believe it or not, even, yes, in a Missouri Synod church. I know that's heresy, but it's actually true. I run into them. People will take umbrage when you will say Islam is different. And the best you can do is just, you know, try to be informed and then, you know, politely try to correct those views.
To speak the truth and speak the truth in love.
Right. Yeah.
With just a few seconds left, Tim, I want to point folks to that the presentation you're doing here in St. Louis at Concordia Seminary. Again, coming up Thursday, October 23rd, 4:15 p.m. in Werner Auditorium at Concordia Seminary. And Fighting for the End of the Christian World, the Eschatology of ISIS and Other Modern Muslim Groups in Light of Islamic History and Doctrines. Our guest today has been Dr. Timothy Furnish. Tim, thanks so much for being our guest today on Faith and Family, helping us understand Islam and especially its appeal to young persons.
It was an honor, Andy. Thank you.
God's blessings and safe travels this week as you're making your way here to St. Louis. Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word, right here on listener-supported worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.